The teachings you are about to receive were freely offered. If you would like to make a donation to support their continuation, please visit us at awakenedheartproject.org.
At the core of, what I want to share today, there's a central practice instruction. And the practice instruction is really just to rest in awakened attention at the truth of each moment as it's arising. It's not exactly a new instruction. It's basically the only instruction we've been giving, one way or another. It's to rest in awakened attention, let's say, but maybe we didn't use the word truth exactly. So maybe we've been saying, allow yourself to rest in awakened attention of what's happening in the moment. So now we're maybe adding just this word, you know, adding rest in the truth of what's happening in this moment, which will take some work and some and a little bit of explaining. Although probably you have an inkling of what it means already without me saying a lot. And I want to start by clarifying something I may have inadvertently said yesterday that left the wrong impression a little bit. Because I think yesterday, when I was talking about resting in awareness, I think inadvertently I may have stressed too much the experiential side of having the experience of resting in awareness, sort of being outside the normal conditioned world. That kind of experience is ephemeral. It comes and it goes in any case. And really what I think is there's some grace involved. Sometimes it happens. You can't really make it happen. Even with the caveats of what I said, how I, you know, what kind of practice that I do. But what we can do each moment, what I think is closer, maybe a more accurate way to say with the practice is to try to notice in every single moment, every individual moment, what's the truth of this moment. That's a much less exalted experience than having this big, bigger ground switch and everything's just unfolding beautifully. And it's really the path to wisdom. So if we can, if we need to learn to be with the truth of each moment, whatever the moment is like. A sad moment is like this. A restful, calm moment is like this. Doubting mind is like this. Thinking mind is like this. Grumbling mind is like this. Rain falling in my face is like this. Stepping is like this. That's what we can know directly. And that's the practice I want to come back to. I want to talk about how to do that and doing that, seeing the truth of each moment. I also made the connection yesterday between awareness and God. What is being aware of the truth of each moment? And I'm suggesting that it's a practice of seeing the divine presence. So when I started meditation practice, I'd already been a student of Reb Zalman for many years and teaching this teaching that from the Baal Shem Tov that everything is God and nothing but God. I was working with that conceptually and trying to experience that as an experience. And so when I learned to meditate, and they said, you know, rest your attention, whatever they said, whatever the teacher said, rest your attention on this, that, or the other thing, it's all God. So they didn't say God in the language they were using, but breath, oh, that's God. Depth, that's God. It's all God. Everything's God, nothing but God. So I made that translation in my head that we're paying attention to God. So in this time, I want to take it again, as I was saying, a little deeper and talk about the relationship between God and truth. So there's a friend of ours, a rabbi, Jonathan Slater, who was in the earliest incarnation of this two-year program. I've been working in two-year meditation programs. This is the third kind of program we're doing that way. The first one was called the Mindfulness Leadership Training Program, and that was just for rabbis. We did a training program like this just needed rabbis and cantors and Jewish educators, but mostly with rabbis. So Jonathan was a student in that retreat and learned about this practice, which he also was a rabbi when he came to this practice. So everything he heard also was, oh, you're talking about God. So he wrote this book called Mindful Jewish Living, which I highly recommend. It's a book combining the kinds of teachings we're doing here and Jewish traditional material, which he's a fairly scholarly type of person, too. So in his book, this is where I first heard this particular quotation. So he cites a Talmudic text from Shabbat, page 55a. It says, Rabbi Hanina taught, truth is the seal of the Holy One. This is what he wrote in his book. Wherever and whenever we recognize the truth of things in this world, we see the divine process in action. In action, in asiyah. You see, whenever you see truth, if you're seeing truth, truth is God's seal. That's like, the seal means like, oh, this is it, this is the real thing. Truth is, that's what you need. If you want to know, is this having anything to do with God? If it's the truth, it has to do with God. According to Talmud, if you believe this teaching in the Talmud. Rabbi Hanina taught, truth is the seal of the Holy One. Knowing the truth of our own experience is a direct realization of the divine presence. Seeing this truth depends on an awakened heart. Without an awakened heart, we are just lost in our normal conditioned ways of misinterpreting the world as characteristic of small mind. So it's not sufficient just to pay attention. So this is where we're expanding the instruction a little bit. So if we pay attention, and that's why we generally say, pay awakened attention. Because if we just pay attention, then we can pay attention, we see things, but we see things through the lens of our conditioning. Now, that's also true, actually, when we pay awakened attention. We're also seeing it through the lens of our conditioning. But the quality, I would say, that comes along with awakened attention is some greater and growing clarity of what that conditioning is as you're seeing the world through that lens. So, it's not that the lens is gone exactly, but as the heart mind gets more and more awakened, maybe another way of saying that is that one's conditioning becomes more and more transparent. It doesn't disappear. One of my teachers said, you know, basically in this life you're born with a personality, and that's you have to play that deck that hand the whole time. So, all of that stuff, you have all this stuff you have to work with. But it becomes somewhat more transparent. So as we get clear what the lenses are, then in each moment we can more and more possibly see the truth. And so in this talk, I'm talking about emet. I'm talking about, this is not truth versus lies. This is not talking about telling the truth, which also is a good, that's a good quality. We could talk about that. But for now, I'm not talking about truth as opposed to lies. I'm talking about really truth as opposed to misconception. And so we're going to talk more. I'll talk more about misconceptions as I get farther into the talk. I mentioned yesterday that I did this retreat in May with Ajahn Sumedho, like most of us who are teaching this practice in Buddhist settings and in Jewish settings, we're all talking about, you know, paying attention to what's happening in this moment, the truth of this moment. But he also focused in on this idea of the truth of each moment. And one of the things I certainly liked about him was that while he's the head of a major lineage, and as I mentioned, he runs a monastery with two monasteries, 25 monks and nuns all training with him. It's a very definite lineage. He's really a universalist, and he's also very open about all of the teachings are just skillful means. What's important is the practice and seeing the truth. And anything that's written down already is just, you know, to the extent it helps you do that, it's great. And that's the only, it doesn't I think it's sort of similar to the way that I look at sacred texts. So maybe that's why I like how he looks at sacred texts. So he was talking about, in the Buddhist tradition, they have their Ashosha Dvarim. There's three things the world depends on. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So the Buddha was this, historically, the Buddha, and then you're talking about this historic figure who lived 2,500 years ago, who we call the Buddha. And he says, when I talk about the Buddha, when I say that's a cornerstone of the practice, I'm not talking about the Buddha the person. Buddha means awakened. So all I'm talking about when I refer to the Buddha, when I look at a Buddha statue, is, pay awakened attention. This means to be awake. So he says, really, it's Buddho to the Buddha. Buddho just means, be awake. Open your eyes, be awake. And Dharma, which is, they certainly have a tradition. It's all written down what the Dharma is. But Dharma is just the truth. And so rather than thinking that there is some person who taught these teachings that you have to follow, he says, I just look at it all as, every moment I try to be Buddha looking at Dhammo. That's all practice. I'm just trying to be awake and look at the truth of the moment. What's the truth of this moment? This moment is like this. This moment has sadness in it. This moment has a smile in it. This moment that some people might be feeling, this moment is, I've heard all this before. I mean, whatever, boredom. Boredom is like this. Just the truth of each moment. That's Buddha looking at Dhammo. So I thought that's the same thing we're talking about. We're trying to pay awakened attention to the truth of this moment. And whenever you see the truth, that's God. The truth is God's seal. So, and if we combine that with what I was saying yesterday, thinking about awareness, resting in awareness, awareness is also God. So it's really sort of God watching God. God in the field of awareness, perhaps maybe an atzilut, watching God's self manifesting in the field. So truth needs to include all the world, in that sense. I wrote the word down just because there are some nice teachings that come just from the Hebrew word itself, which is, if we're going to if you look at the three letters in the word truth, Aleph, Mem, and Tav, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet is the Aleph, the first letter of this word, and Tav is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which is the last letter of this word, and Mem is the middle letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which is the middle of this word. So the word Emet, our teachers always said, it's just a shorthand for saying this is the whole story. Emet is the whole story, from Aleph to Tav, A to Z, everything's included. Everything, Emmet has to pay attention to everything. The whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And nothing but the truth is really hard, I think, but it's hard to do it that way. So, just a quick teaching, Reb Zalman mentioned this to me when I was talking about this talk. So if you look at this word, this idea that it has to be the whole truth, if you leave off that Aleph, on that word. So Aleph is generally thought of as Esh, fire, in this word, and Aleph is sort of the vertical connection. So if we leave out the divine spark of this practice, and you just pay attention to what's happening on the earth plane, then it's mit. Then it just means death. You're not really alive without that spark in there. It's almost as if, that's really cute. And it means something like, if you just get caught up like, there's so much suffering in the world, I get sick all the time, my parents weren't nice to me, that's true. Right? If you just get stuck in that and you don't see it from any kind of bigger perspective, it's pretty hard to be alive. And you wish you were dead. Some people do wish they were dead when they get stuck in that place. So it's not just that it's cute that we take off the Aleph. There's something more that's called for. And if you take off the Tau, which is grounded in this earth plane, then you have Eden, and all you're left with, which means gift, which is sort of just doubt. It's all airy and everything, but it's not grounded. say, left with me. So I came at this idea of doing a talk on truth, and I had some of these ideas, things I wanted to share, and then I thought, okay, now I'm going to go looking for some source material, too, and see what other people have said. And I remembered a line, the first line I thought that I really liked. I thought, I'm going to find out where this line is from. It says, the truth will set you free. I thought, that's nice. I like that. I like that line. So I went looking for it, and it comes from John, chapter 8, verse 32. At first, I'm disappointed. It's from the New Testament. not so serious. I mean, I would have preferred the truth if it had been in Proverbs, but I wasn't really disappointed. But I would have had a preference. it's a good line. And so I looked. I looked in John, and then I looked at the. Since I was doing this already, I looked at the verse before that too. So in verse 31, right before that, it says, "To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, 'If you hold to my teachings, you are really my disciples. The truth will set you free.'" So it's like, then I was like, "Oh, yeah." So I mentioned this to Zalman that I looked up the truth that you create, and I was like surprised to find it from the New Testament, and I said it's connected to the needing to convert the Jews, and he said, "Well, which gospel is it from?" I said, "That's from John." He said, "Oh, it's from John. John is the latest. I don't know gospel history very much, but John's a much later gospel, and this is so the earlier gospels don't have anything like that kind of material about needing to convert the Jews over. The later gospels do, when there's already much." I think it's 100 years later than the earlier Gospels, if I remember right. And there's much more of an animosity and a struggle going on at that point. So there's more of a polemic that comes out in John. That's how Zalman understood it, anyway. But it also raised an interesting question, because it came from the New Testament, which is, if we're going to really look at the truth, what happens when the truth isn't what you want it to be? But what happens when the truth isn't exactly what your preconceived notions are about what the truth should look like, ought to look like? And then what do you do? When you have one set of beliefs, and then there's the truth of your own experience. So that's something for all of us to look at, certainly. And so coming into the each moment of experience with our preconceived ideas is certainly going to be a central piece of the work we need to do. So again, the core practice that comes along with this, rather than trying to get into some sort of exalted state of looking, the core practice is just, what's the truth of this moment? Sitting is like this. Giving a talk is like this. Listening is like this. Mind wandering is like this. Calm mind is like this. Preferring calm mind is like this. All of those things arise, and the idea is to try to meet them with judgment, without judgment, and just say, "Oh, it's like this. This experience is like this. It's like this." Sylvia used to have a similar teaching. She would say, but she'd say it in Yiddish, which made it a lot more Jewish, too. You look at the moment, Azei Yiddish, which is in the Yiddish. So it goes, Azei Gaitis, Azei Yiddish. And so you look at this moment, this is the way it is. It's like this, Azei Yiddish. So working with the truth is intimately connected to acquiring wisdom, dispelling ignorance, opening the heart of kindness and compassion, acting justly, creating peace, knowing God, resting in divine awareness. So fortunately I found some Jewish texts as well, as the New Testament. So in Pirkei Avot, instance, is could be translated as a principle ethics. It's a book on ethical teaching, sometimes called Ethics of the Fathers. But the word avot also is sometimes used to mean a main category. It's really the teaching in this case, in that book, probably is more like these are the main categories of ethics. So Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam, which sounds very familiar, because very close to the verse we built this whole program around, but he comes with this a little later than the verse we work with is in chapter 1, I think verse 3. But so Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam kayam, al ha'emet, v'al ha'din, v'al ha'shalom. So he said, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, the world is sustained by three things. By truth, by justice, and by peace. As it has been stated, speak every man the truth to his neighbor. Execute the judgment of truth and peace in your gates. So the way Jewish teachers work is they cite others just like I'm citing them. They cite some other text for what they want to say, what they're saying. So, and in that text it says, execute the judgment of truth, peace, and peace in your gates. So I thought it was an important thing too, that not only are you saying truth is one of the pillars, but it's even mentioned first in this teaching, that the continued existence of the world, is based on truth. Truth, justice, and peace. And the same teacher in the mission, it's always good to look in a text, we'll come before, we'll come after a little bit just to see, as I did with John. And so Shimon ben Gamliel, the son of Rabban Gamliel, said, it was also quoted in the verse right before this verse where he talks about truth, how important truth is. And in that verse, in 1:17, he says, all my life I've been raised among the sages, and I have not found anything better for oneself than silence. Study is not the primary thing, but action. Whoever talks excessively brings about sin. I think you could even do that last line. You might play with it a little bit. But whoever talks excessively brings about sin. I think you could add whoever thinks excessively brings about sin. Maybe I'll get to that. I'll come back to that a little bit. Now there's nothing, no problem with thinking, the excessive part of the problem. But when I read this, that Shimon ben Gamliel was saying how important truth is, that he was this guy really into silence, I sort of felt like this is a kindred soul. This is somebody who, is doing the same thing we're doing. That's really what it felt to me. And it also turns out, as I read a little bit more about him, he was the father of Yehuda Hanasi. He was the father of the guy who put the Mishnah together. The Mishnah is the first codification of Jewish law, of the oral tradition. So after the Torah was finished, nothing was written down, like you put about the oral tradition. But then the Mishnah gets written, and this guy's son, the guy whose father believed that silence is the best thing, and that's not study but action, his son is the one who put the Mishnah together. And in Proverbs, another verse I liked, in Proverbs, this is about chapter 23, verse 23. Buy the truth and sell it not. Also wisdom and instruction and understanding. Emet kenei ve'al timkor. So buy the truth and sell it not. So I just pondered over that a little bit myself, thinking about that in the commentaries on it. But I think he's saying, certainly for one thing, I think he's saying, you got to work hard. You have to invest. If you want the truth, it's not free. You have to, I don't know that he meant buy, give somebody money to give it to it. But I think he meant you have to, you got to make an investment. If you want the truth, you have to work hard to get the truth. But then you give it away for free. It's not for selling. Once if you, whatever you know about the truth, it's for giving away free. But pay whatever you need to pay. Do whatever you need to do to get it. Just don't, but truth is not meant to be held on to. Do whatever you need to get it, and then pass it along, pass it on. So in Psalm 85, and this is going to be the lead into one more midrash. This is verses 11 and 12 of Psalm 85. Loving kindness and truth meet, righteousness and peace kiss each other. Which one commentary said confront. So there is some question in this verse whether it seems like they're getting along or maybe they're not getting along. But and that's going to come up in the midrash I'm going to share in a minute. Loving kindness and truth meet, righteousness and peace kiss each other. And then in verse 12, right after that, it says, truth shall spring from the earth, and righteousness shall look down from heaven. Remembering those verses, so now I'm going to switch over to Midrash. Midrash is a rabbinic commentary on the Torah. In this case, the Midrash, this is the Midrash to Genesis. These are rabbinic exegesis, rabbinic explanations, sort of stories. Lots of stories we've actually heard about. Sometimes we think, oh, is that a story from the Torah? No, it's actually it's a story, it's a Midrash about the Torah. Anyway, so this is a Midrash. So from Midrash Rabbah to Genesis. And it's an explanation of the verse in Genesis chapter 1:26. And that's the verse where God is creating human beings. And the Torah says, and you probably have all heard this verse, and Elohim said, let us make Adam in our own image, in our own likeness. So it's in the plural. It's all in the plural. Let us make man in our image and our own likeness. Vayom Elohim naaseh Adam b'tzalmenu kidmutenu. So the Midrash has to explain. That's a little confusing. Let us make one God. Who's the us? So the Midrash has to explain this. So in the Midrash it says, Rabbi Shimon said, and I'm dying to find out if it's the same Shimon who said this thing about silence but and truth. It could be because he was interested in truth, but maybe he's, but I don't know. Because there were lots of Rabbi Shimon. So Rabbi Shimon said, at the moment the Holy One chose to create the first human being, the ministering angels broke up into factions. So for us is going to be these angels, and they're on opposing sides. Two sides. Some of them said, create him, while others said, don't do it. Thus it is written, loving kindness and truth will meet, righteousness and peace will kiss. So they, as their proof text, they say, at least Rabbi Shimon says, takes these four qualities from that verse of Psalms that seem to be, it seemed originally they were like forces, maybe they're opposing forces. And he says, he says that's the verse he's pinning it on, that they broke up into two groups. And here's how the two groups broke down. Loving kindness said, create him, for he will do acts of loving kindness. Truth said, don't create him, for he's drenched in lies. Righteousness said, create him, for he will do much tzedakah. Peace said, don't do it, or is essentially quarrelsome. So I found it really interesting too. Like, which side? Who took which side? Even I thought it was sort of interesting. And, but then it goes on. What did the Holy One do? This was really fascinating. What did the Holy One do? He took truth and cast it toward the earth. Thus it is written, and truth will be cast to the earth. In the book of Daniel, it says, "V'tashlech emet artza." He cast truth out to the earth. When he did that, and the Midrash continues, so God took truth and threw it down to the earth plane. Some people say actually into the earth, to the earth, into the earth. Maybe buried it into the earth. The ministering angel said, sovereign of the universe, why do you shame the leader of your court? In truth. So truth is the leader to us. Let truth rise from the earth. Thus it's written in Psalm 85:12, truth will arise from the earth. So when this happened, so originally it's a 2-2 split. So God, in essence, had to, maybe God exercised God's veto, so to speak, and threw truth out. That made a 2-1. Whatever. He he got rid of truth, threw it to the earth, and that's how human beings could be created then. Because the truth was down here. And then this, so then one of the other angels said, you know, how can you do that? How can you change the leader of your court? And then another person adding on to this midrash, Rabbi Huna of Sepphoris, he sort of added on to that story. He says, I thought this was cute. While the ministering angels were arguing with one another and disputing with one another, the Holy One created Adam and then said, what are you arguing about? Man's already made. I don't have much to say about that line, but I thought it was pretty funny. So I want to talk about this midrash a little bit. Obviously, like that in terms of this talk too, that as a focus on truth, and somehow truth being related to it also. Truth is here. Truth is here in the earth, and that's central to why God's willing to allow human beings to be created somehow. So. The Midrash is trying to understand Genesis, right? So it's interesting. This is a talk on truth. So obviously, Rabbi Shimon was not there. Because I started working on explaining this Midrash. And I go, like, who says God did this? And what are they talking about? What does that all mean, even? You know, it's a parable. It's a parable. It's not certainly not a first-hand eyewitness account. Rabbi Shimon is not giving a truthful account. So maybe it's a true story. What is a true story? So maybe it's a story that has truth in it, about truth. And in that sense, Rabbi Shimon is trying to understand, basically what Rabbi Shimon is trying to do, and with the Midrash, they're not just trying to explain the verse. And they are trying to explain the verse, but they're trying to understand. I think probably what's going on is they themselves are trying to understand, Rabbi Shimon is trying to understand what is the relationship in this, of various forces. Being a human being, what's it like being a human being, and how do we relate to these various qualities that we all talk about and think about? Peace, justice, you know, truth, loving kindness. What does that have to do with human beings? That's what I think he's trying to look at, and doing so through the vehicle of looking at that text. We might all ask why we were created. You know, that is a common question that comes up in philosophical circles and in Jewish circles. I think in the Talmud too, would it have been better for human beings not to have been created? You can argue about such a thing. But certainly you could think about it. You could think about, I certainly, again, like I was saying before about mates, there are numerous people who are not so happy that they were born, given a choice. In fact, Ajahn Sumedho said something like that, when he looked at the suffering in his life, you know, when he was caught in there, he didn't feel like it was worth it. So he used to have such thoughts. So by Shimon, all of us are trying to figure out what these forces have to do in our lives. Shalom, the force of peace, says not to do it. When we look around, we see how little peace there is in the world. You know, maybe it's not such a good thing in terms of peace that human beings were created. You know, that's a valid question, anyways, to ask. Again, just about the quality of peace. Chesed says yes. I think we have Chesed, love, unbounded loving kindness, because with all of our mishigas, you know, with all of our craziness, we also see that. Sometimes we're capable of that. Certainly we, not everybody, but we encounter people who are capable of unbelievable acts of loving kindness. You know, that sort of mitigates in favor of it. And tzedek says sometimes we act righteously, you know. So then we get to truth. So truth said, don't create him, for he is drenched in lies. So now I want to sort of focus some more on this, on that line, on the concept of truth. So, first of all, that was an interesting phrase too. He doesn't say that human beings are going to tell lies all the time. And he could have said something like that. He says they are drenched in lies. Right? I think that language is closer to the language of their loss. They're in misconception. They're conditioned to not see things clearly. That's closer to what that means, anyway. To be drenched in lies, with misconceptions, false views of reality. Okay, then truth, and then this midrash, truth gets thrown to the earth. And that was crucial. Truth had to be in this earth plane in order for human beings to get anywhere. I think that's sort of that's certainly what I'm suggesting too in the whole practice. You know, pay attention to the truth. That is, and we need to have a relationship with the truth. Our very humanness, our ability to be awakened human beings, depends on having a relationship with this quality that was thrown down here into this earth plane. Maybe God through the fruits of the earth because we need to find it. And then there's also a question, even coming from these verses, are we in truth going to be friends or enemies? Initially it seems like we're going to be enemies, but maybe it's saying we have to turn around. I want to come back to that story because the story comes up again in the teachings of another teacher I wanted to mention. So this is a book called The Passion for Truth, Abraham Joshua Heschel, and it's a book talking about two Hasidic rabbis, but mostly one of them being the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, but mostly it's a book trying to compare the Baal Shem Tov to another teacher that he was very moved by, who was another Hasidic master who lived in the town of his name was Menachem Mendel, and he lived in the town of Kutsk. So he's called the Kutzker Rebbe. So he was also, he started his own Hasidic dynasty. And Heschel looks at these two rabbis. The main feature of the Kutzker Rebbe was his impassioned embrace of truth. He emphasized the quality of truth above all other qualities. But for him, it was a kind of truth we would call brutal honesty. He wanted the truth. He really wanted the truth, and nothing but the truth. He wanted nothing to do with anything that wasn't fully of the truth. I'll read a little bit of what Heschel said about him. Classical Hasidism tried to reach all Jews. The Kutzker was interested only in the select, the few. He inscribed one word on his banner, Emet, truth. To achieve truth, he was ready to sacrifice everything else. Worst of all were the imitations of the truth, and the closer to the original, the worse. The way to truth was a tortuous one. For its sake, one must do away with habit, with emotional bias, with all kinds of outward appearances, even those hallowed over generations, which is in some ways very different than the Hasidic model, right? Just, you know, dressed alike, they follow the same teaching. So he wanted to dump all of that. He's only interested in the core inner truth, not outer form. The way to truth is a tortuous one. For its sake, one must do away with habit, with emotional bias, with all kinds of outward appearances, even those hallowed over the generations. Here's a line that relates to what we're doing. If a man offered prayers today because he did so yesterday, he was worse than the scoundrels of the Kutzker. Every day, prayer had to have a fresh approach. One ought to search out the truth daily as if it had not been known before. Truth taught the Kutzker could be reached only by the way of the utmost freedom. Such freedom meant not to give in to any outside pressures, not to conform, not to please oneself or anyone else. He did not preach asceticism or negate this world per se, but he insisted, however, that to get to the truth, a man had to go against himself and society. This quest required total abandonment of self. So when the Kutzker talks about this same parable, the same midrash that I was reading, he uses the language that truth is in the grave. Truth is buried in the grave. Not just even in the earth, it is buried. Truth is buried. So and it's going to, it's not, if truth is in the grave, then guess where you got to go and how to get there if you want truth. You know, it's just what I sort of just read. You have to let go of all these outer forms. You have to die to all this, all the conditioning, to all the preconceived notions. That's the only way you can get to truth, because truth is in the ground. Truth is buried. Truth is in the grave. Heschel sort of summarizes the situation. For most of us, life is a series of evasions, pretensions, substitutes, and rationalizations. We do not see the world as it is, but as a projection of ourselves. And so we are prisoners of delusions that hold us in their spell even after we become aware of their deceptiveness. Gradually, pretensions are converted into certainties, rationalizations become entangled, and madness sets in. This is Heschel. I remember Joanna, if you remember, Joanna mentioned on the first night that Heschel said, Heschel's quote was, prayer needs to be a subversive experience. So, he's caught in the Heschel, in the book, you see Heschel is caught in a dilemma, because he loved the Baal Shem Tov too, but he also resonates the Kutsk. Probably his personality was in Kutsk. And he addresses that in the book in some ways. So Heschel goes on, falsehood is not merely a discrepancy between what is said and what is meant. It twists and distorts the basis of a man's life, deceiving him into believing he lives in a reality that does not exist. A person living a lie and taking it to be the truth moves in a world of self-delusion. And I wrote next to that, wake up. You got to wake up. That's the whole point. This is it's not the rosiest view of human nature, perhaps, but this is how he understands it. It's how Heschel and how Kutsk understood it, I think, how Heschel understood it. So if we don't do something, if we don't wake up, then we're just going to be in this mate thing. Where Heschel explains the two sides a little bit more. The Kutzker's presence recalls a nightmare of mendacity, falsehood. The presence of the Baal Shem Tov is an assurance that falsehood dissolves into compassion through the power of love. This is how Heschel ends the introduction. Honesty, authenticity, integrity, without love, may lead to the ruin of others or oneself or both. On the other hand, love, fervor, or exaltation alone may seduce us into living in a fool's paradise, a wise man's hell. Maybe the Aleph could be Ahava also. Ahava is love, thank you. So I think that the teaching then from the Kutzker about truth is that in order to get truth, we have to work through all the deception. This is not unique to Kutzker to this talk, but various spiritual teachers have said, you know, in order to really live, you have to die. You have to die to the old. We say it in a simple way. We have to, in each moment, you have to die to the last moment and nothing else. You can't be in this moment if you're still stuck in the last moment, and the way the last moment looks. So this whole idea we're talking about, while it sounds like when you say, oh, let's rest in the truth of each moment, that sounds good. That sounds good. But it carries with it, and let go of everything. Let go of all your preconceived notions about what the truth is going to be, or else you won't be able to see the truth. That's not so easy to do. So, one of the, want to say, maybe put out a thought about what makes it possible to do this. So this is very hard work, actually, to let go of everything. It may sound scary. So that's where we have to put chesed, unbounded loving kindness, back into the mix. And chesed and emet are actually quite frequently paired in the tradition. So that even in that psalm, they were paired. They go hand in hand in a certain way. And it wasn't so clear that the psalm was saying they're enemies. But somehow they are hand in hand. They're two things that you need to work. So certainly I would say, in my experience, that's necessary. That if we're going to do this work of opening up to the truth of each moment, we need to do it. And this is how we are suggesting that we do it all the time in the instructions. We need to try to open up to the truth of each moment with as much loving kindness about whatever that reality is as we can. And as much as you can, instead of looking at the truth of this moment with harsh judgment at it. I mean, sometimes the moment is hard enough as it is, as you know. And so to come in there with harsh judgment is not going to do, we're going to get us stuck in that matrix. So we have to go in there with ahava, with love, with unbounded chesed, with unbounded loving kindness. You might remember I did another verse where I can quote, well, the Torah verse, which I've talked about here a number of times, and we've, last week, if not the first week of each camp, we did this as a guided visualization. But it's the, it's sort of my take on the understanding of what happened when Moses wanted to see God face to face, and when God says, nobody can see me, you can't see me face to face, nobody can see my face and live. So I'm not going to do the whole thing now because that took the whole session. But the upshot of that was God does agree to let Moses see see God's face, and Moses goes up the mountain, God comes, God's back is to Moses, so Moses sees God's face, but he sees it from the inside. They're face-to-face like this, God's face and Moses' face. And from that, what happens in that moment is Moses is then seeing out and looking at the world through God's eyes, and the line of the Torah, the teaching that the Torah says is how God sees the world, how Moses saw the world in that moment is, Adonai Adonai ha-rachum v'chanun, erech ha-payim, the rav chesed v'emet. And there are a link. So even in that verse, so when you see the world through God's eyes, through in as we were saying yesterday, in awareness, when you're resting in awareness, seeing the experience from God's eyes, then chesed and emet are a pair. And that's been my experience, too. I mean, I think that's I don't know what the Kutzker's experience was, but most people who talk about what those moments are like, truth and love do go together. That we see the truth, and it's not with judgment, and it's not with criticism. The heart just opens up. Okay? So I think they do really work as a fair test of memory. It certainly would be helpful to us if we're going to do this practice. I'm going to briefly introduce one more piece of work then. So we want to do this work. We want to open up to the experiencing in an awakened way the truth of each moment. So I want to highlight three things and that get in the way of that. Before we then talk about sort of what gets in the way of clear seeing, sometimes called hindrances, this is another version of and it looks a little bit more specifically as opposed to what gets in the way of clear seeing, like something that clouds you. It's more what gets in the way that pulls you away altogether. It's like it's like chains that keep you from even doing this work in the first place. And there's three main things I'd mention in that connection. So what the first one is addiction to self, that we actually are addicted to this small sense of self. I'll say a little more about that again. You know, that we don't want to, the self wants to be the self. And we're very, we're addicted to the self. Bernie Glassman is a Zen teacher. His opening line in talks for years used to be, you know, hi, I'm Bernie, I'm addicted, I'm an addict, I'm addicted to Bernie. You know, I guess it's sort of a play on the 12 step. Right? I'm addicted to Bernie. Who's not addicted to them? Who here doesn't feel like they're sort of not addicted to themselves? Who's not attached to this being that you think you're walking around as? So, and that's a preconceived notion, perhaps. So, I mean, this is a question of the truth to look at. How much, and so I guess I'm making the assertion that gets in the way of seeing the truth. Because we want it to be this way and that way. In the sense, so there's an addiction to the sense of self that it's a pulls in the opposite direction of seeing the truth. There's a similar addiction and attachment to cultural conditioning. So if self is personal conditioning, then we also have cultural conditioning that we're attached to. That this is the way we should do things. This is, my son should go to college. Shouldn't be doing what he's doing. He should be in college. That's cultural conditioning. You know, is this meditation really Jewish? You know, that's culture. These are cultural minds. Be better if I was thinner. You know, that's both personal and cultural, right? You know, that the sense of self also comes from what the society is saying. So we have cultural conditioning. And then the last thing that pulls us away is doubt, which we've talked about doubt before. But Ajahn Sumedho had a really good line. I've never heard this pithy teaching about doubt, which he says, doubt is just too much thinking. Excessive thinking. It's just excessive. And that's why I set through that line in earlier when I was reading from the Midrash, from Proverbs. Because too much thinking, if you think too much, the truth is you can make a case for every side of every argument. And that's what doubt is. That's like you could figure out why you should do this or why you shouldn't do this. Why you should be with this person, why you shouldn't be with that person. So one of the things that just gets in the way of seeing the truth is too much thinking. And so we need practices to remind us to move out of excessive thinking. I wrote this up just so I could try to capture everything. It's an experience you may have had, sort of, in one way or another. So, for example, sitting here with restlessness. The last was so great. I was so focused. I should count breaths, get more concentrated, get absorbed so that I can see that there really is no self and be connected to God. I'm such a bad meditator. There's no point in doing this. I'm wasting my time. I could be campaigning for Obama and making real change that we can depend on. If I had started doing that a year ago, I might be a White House aide instead of sitting here so bored. So that's like all three. That's like the view of self. The self wants to be a self, wants it to look a certain way, thinks it should be a certain way. You know, oh, concentration practice. That's cultural view. You know, like, oh, this is how it should work. It should be this. This is what the teachings say, so it should work this way. If I pray this way, this will happen. And there's doubt, because it's just like, you know, I should be doing this, I should be doing that. So I think probably you all experience this all the time. And if you did it more in awareness, it would have looked a little more like, oh, restlessness. Restlessness is like this. Ah, wanting to be a good meditator. Ah, that's addiction to self. Addiction to self is like this. Thinking there's a certain way to practice is like this. Oh, that cultural conditioning is like this. Unsure what I should be doing is like this. Oh, doubt is like this. Excessive thinking is like this. And you notice these things directly. And the more you can be in the truth at each moment, then you can see these things. So you practice. These are all things to watch for. Watch if this is not in fact happening from moment to moment. Watch how much wanting your experience to be a certain way so that you could be this or be that or be a good meditator. You know, see how much that story comes in, you know, or thinking it should be this way. You know, oh, they're teaching the Buddhist stuff. That's not good. You know, but see how much cultural conditioning affects how you're willing to greet the moment. And the moment is just the moment. All those things are extra that get added on. But the moment includes moments of mind, moments of feelings. That's why as Joanna was teaching in the instructions of 2 days, it's like you want to notice all of those different realms and notice arising and passing in those realms. And now we're sort of adding, also notice how much clinging to self comes in into each moment with the body, with thoughts, how much clinging to cultural view comes in, how much thinking leads to death. I'll close this with one last thing I had heard about truth. So I was trying to remember all the quotes I had heard about truth. And this is a story I remembered. I went at a concert once with my first year in college with Richie Havens. So it was great. I loved his performances. Although I loved the music. He did have a tendency, at least when I saw him back then in the 70s, he tended to talk at least as much. He actually talked more than he played. And it's pretty clear he's pretty stoned. I mean, he's just good at these stoned raps. But at one point, as I was listening to him, I think he was talking too much. But then he said this line, which I thought was really cute and sort of fits in a little bit of the closing. So Richie Havens said, remember how when you used to watch the Superman show on TV that said, because he was doing a whole anti-war rap too. Mostly he was talking about the war and anti-war stuff. But so he said, remember when we used to watch the Superman show on TV and the show would say about Superman, that Superman stood for truth, justice, and the American way. And then Richie Havens said, I thought truth and justice were the American way. So I remember that line. So sort of keeping that in mind, may we all serve God through a loving embrace of the truth of each moment we are given. And may the wisdom we get from this lead to more justice as well as happiness in the world.